Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's August the 26th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my boys, for freedom is the rising of the moon.
No Edgar Steele update this week because there doesn't seem to be any motion in the case. There's going to be a lot of that from now on, nothing but silence as everyone waits around for something to happen. I wouldn't be too surprised to see a few more delays and postponement of the trial date until after Christmas. I'd like to discuss that thing I mentioned last week, but I still can't get any kind of confirmation on it, and so I'll give it another week and really turn the internet over before I say anything. I've been told I'm being too apologetic on the air here, so I won't apologize for the fact that my voice sounds like Edgar Allan Poe's Raven croaking nevermore. My lungs are still in bad shape this week, another tribute to the AMA's lock on the health industry. I'm sure if I'd been able to take a short course of antibiotics a week ago, tetracycline or something of the kind, it would have knocked this respiratory infection right in the head, but no! Can't walk into a drugstore and buy a mild antibiotic over the counter in this country like you can in most other countries, including Canada, I think. No, can't do that here. Must go to the doctor so the doctor can charge you $100 or so for the visit and maybe another $25 just for writing the script. That's the AMA's guiding principle. The doctor is like Don Corleone. He has to always wet his beak in anything medical or healthcare related. After all, the man has to keep up payments on his Porsche or his Maserati, not to mention his luxury condo and aspirin. Okay. Oh, and while I'm on the subject of healthcare ripoffs, this should interest a lot of us who are in my situation. I got my first look at Obamacare the other day. The interim Obamacare, which geezers like me with pre-existing conditions can now get voluntarily until 2012 or whenever it becomes mandatory, will run me $8,000 a year if I take a $2,500 deductible, which is so high as to render the whole concept of insurance meaningless. And if I go for a $500 deductible, which would be almost as hard for me to come up with, the cost is something like $15,000 a year. And no, I'm not making that up. I got it right off the Washington state government's website. I'm not sure what the point is in the government offering health insurance, the premiums of which are so sky high that they'd actually cost me more than getting full treatment and paying cash for my medical problems most likely would, if I had any cash. Nonetheless, that's the case. I understand this program is so absurdly expensive that as of Monday, August 23rd, only two people in the whole state of New Jersey have signed up for it. Obviously, at some point, blacks and beaners and other Democratic constituencies will end up getting their medical care more or less free, and the few remaining white people who still have any money will end up paying for it all. Redistribution of wealth in the form of free health care for parasites. Thanks for nothing, Barry. Okay, first email this week is from John in Basel, Switzerland. Hi, Harold. I hope you'll find some time in a future program to talk a bit about the Bradley contention that the Jews are partly descended from the Neanderthals. If nothing else, knowing your style, it'll be very entertaining, and though that may not be your aim, it does help to bring people back for more goodies and their by to get your message over. I'd also like to commend you for your recent description of climate in the Pacific Northwest. For people like me on this side of the Atlantic, that is indeed useful. This is something you could do sort of by the way throughout the year to mention what the weather has been like. For those of you who are not familiar with this topic, this week I put a post on the Thought Crime blog discussing a book by a Jew named Michael Bradley to the effect that Jews are in fact the descendants of Neanderthal men, citing a lot of DNA evidence to support that contention, and also that their hatred of Gentiles goes back to the conflict 30,000 years ago or so between the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnons, who were most likely our own Aryan ancestors. And basically, the Jews are still trying to win the ancient war of aggression and wipe us all out to this day, which of course they are. Just the question arises as to why and whether or not this is in some way genetic. Well, yeah, I suppose it's possible. I've already discussed in a previous podcast my beliefs regarding the origins of our own race, which are pretty much backed up by archaeological and historical evidence. Now, that is to say that we originated from, well, wherever we originated from. Anyway, we just kind of appeared in the area around Lake Baikal in what's now central Russia, and we began our series of migrations that eventually took us to the shores of the Puget Sound from that particular locality. Of course, the big mystery is how we got there, and what connection we may have, if any, with earlier humanoid species, such as the Neanderthals, Cro-Magnons, and those fossilized monkey people they keep digging up in Africa. That whole Neanderthal-Cro-Magnon scene in Europe and near Asia is odd. You see, Cro-Magnons were not only our own ancestors, they were actually apparently superior to us in certain ways, such as brain size. Now, they more or less wiped out the Neanderthals in Asia approximately 50,000 years ago, and in Europe about 30,000 years ago. But there have been some skeletal remains found in Spain and Portugal that are around 24,000 years old, which indicate that there was, in fact, some interbreeding and race mixing going on, and it could be that modern white people's diminished cranial capacity compared to the Cro-Magnon original, was one of the first ill effects our people ever incurred due to race mixing. In other words, whatever our original design may have been, and wherever it came from, we seem to have diluted it and evolved downward a bit, and that may be one reason why we still haven't been able to absolutely establish our dominion over the Earth. We're not the original model. I will say this, I genuinely believe that Jews are some kind of different and essentially hostile order of creation from the rest of mankind, as witness the fact that they have historically never been able to get along with anybody. And no other people or nation on the face of the earth has ever been able to stand having them around for too long. Some species just seem to be natural enemies, like sharks and dolphins, and they refuse to swim in the same waters together. A Christian identity person would claim that the Jews are satanic in origin, while white people are divine, and they may well be right, although perhaps not quite in the literal sense. Next, we have another MP3 file from Gretchen the Librarian in Connecticut.
So, how did I awaken? I think I'll just try and do the same thing as Harold was doing recently and just talk off the cuff here. Well, I had the experience of going to a prep school, and while I was there, it really opened up a lot of venues, new venues, into seeing the world in new ways. And while I was there, this was my second year into this prep school experience, we had an assembly. Now, this is going back, I mean, I'm dating myself here because this was back in the 80s, quite frankly. Bishop Tutu's daughter came to our school, and she told us about the situation in South Africa from her perspective. She was saying how unfair the apartheid was. She talked about the ANC. She said they were not communist, and that there was this horrible situation, even though I was always opposed to interracial marriage. At that time, I was naive and adolescent, and I guess just didn't have a clear enough sense of the world. And I found her story very compelling because I'm a very fair person, very fair-minded. I decided to go to a Vespers meeting that she said was going to take place nearby in a few days. And it was a place that I could easily get to. I didn't have to drive. I could just walk because it was near my house. And I went there, and there were two things that really struck me about it. First thing that really struck me was I saw several black-white couples, and they all had these mulatto children. It struck me that this movement that she's part of that has to do with the ANC and all of this movement that she's talking about, it's really a race-mixing movement. It's not just a fairness, you know, everybody being fair and people fairly and treating people kind way, but it's about race-mixing. The second thing that struck me about this meeting was the fact that they sung the Internationale, which was a song that I wasn't familiar with at the time, but when I went home, I told told my mother, I said they were singing this song called The International, and it was essentially a song about race mixing, if you really listened to the lyrics and interpreted them. And my mother said, that's a communist anthem. So right away I knew, okay, she obviously lied to me about the communist part. Not that I care what ideology she is, but or her friends are, but even more importantly, it's a race-mixing movement. And I realized that this movement, and I mean, I was in eighth grade at the time, but I could clearly see it, that our race, we have a very fragile genome. And if they've come, essentially these were white women married to black men, if they've come for white women, then that's accessing our genome. And that's taking everything from us, because our genome is the most important thing. And if they're taking that and they're accessing our genome, then that's utter destruction. So I saw that. And at that time, this was a very liberal prep school. And I really didn't want to create that time waves at my school. And they're really, I don't really see any point in doing that. I had enough academic difficulties at this school because it was a difficult curriculum, frankly. And so, I mean, I knew what I was supposed to say. And I, all through school, I would say whatever I was supposed to say, because I think that's the smartest thing to do in an academic situation. You don't want to antagonize your professors, fellow students, people that you have to work with in that academic venue if you're hoping to do well or to do at least well enough and to graduate. But that was one of my, I guess my second awakening. My first and more essential awakening actually happened when I was in the third grade, and that was when I was at home over the weekend, and my father was watching these films of Hitler that, you know, are on television a lot, and I was really struck by the film that I was seeing and really mesmerized, and asked my father, you know, who is this, and what was he doing? And he kind of explained it in a very simplistic way. And, you know, at that point, I was excited and I wanted to put a swastika on my notebook. So he showed me how to draw one, and I put a little swastika on one of my school notebooks at the time. And I, of course, I went to school with that, and it was just a small one. I mean, it wasn't huge or anything. I don't know why I wasn't warned against doing this, but maybe my father didn't know that I was putting it on my notebook. I was at parochial school at this time, and my teacher noticed it, and she said, you know, do you know how many people they killed and whatever? But that really didn't deter me, because I didn't really care what she would say or anyone would say or claim about the Holocaust. I was very revved up by the ideology. And I realized that I felt at the time that the ideology was in contrast to the church and probably in contrast to Christianity, but I was so enthused that I didn't really care about that, and I just made a kind of an oath, well, really an oath at that time that, you know, I had to persist in this no matter what. But, you know, I was quite an extreme individual, and at least in the hypothetical sense. So I was thinking that in my mind. And after that, I really had no interest in the church. I had no particular interest in Christianity. I totally turned away from it. I know that maybe contradicts in some ways the story I was just telling, but it was like I had these two awakenings that I sort of woke up in the third grade, maybe turned it off for a while, and then re-woke up in the eighth grade. And so that's what was occurring to me. I look around at the world, I see this controversy over the mosque in New York, and what I essentially see more and more is I see us essentially ceding lands, ceding power to others, to those who are non-white. It's almost as if we don't question it, we just sort of give away, and we give away more and more all the time. And of course, another thing I hear a lot about on Fox News lately is, of course, the situation in Arizona. Some people saying that they want to go down to Arizona, they want to fight there. I think that's a bad idea. Arizona, I look at the terrain, flat terrain, there's no cover, there's inland, so we've got a landlocked situation. The climate is too warm, doesn't have the seasons that we're adapted for. I mean, I don't know why. I've always, in summertime, I enjoy warm weather. But I know that too much sun isn't good for us. You know, things like skin cancer happening. So I would honestly say the territory of Arizona and other inland landlocked territories, you know, just totally wrong for us. So I'm not enthusiastic about that territory whatsoever. Okay. All right. Well, that's what I've, you know, come up with for today. And I think that I'll wrap this up right now. And okay, comrades, so I thank you for listening. Good day.
In her presentation there, Gretchen mentioned a song called The Internationale, and as I was listening to her, it occurred to me that many of you people listening to this, especially our woefully ignorant younger movement generation, don't even know what The Internationale is, never mind what it sounds like. So I'm going to remedy that, knowing full well that there are going to be idiots out there who gasp and moan, "Oh, Hurl's playing communist music. God damn, Hurl must be a communist himself." No, 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 Rufus, get the pork fat out of your ears. I'm playing this music because this is something you people need to know. Anytime you hear this song, that's a dead giveaway that something is hinky and far more lefty than mere polite champagne socialism and Marxism light. You hear the Internationale and you're dealing with the real stuff, the blood red stuff. The Internationale is the official anthem of world communism and has been for 140 years. It was written in 1871 for the Paris Commune, which was a brief attempt to take over France by the Reds, the first such attempt in modern times, but certainly not the last. There are still some communist countries in the world where it's played, such as Cuba, North Korea, and North Vietnam. Maybe China as well. I don't know if the Chinese still officially consider themselves to be communists. There are also countries in the world that are under assault by communist insurgencies, either led from the bottom, such as in Colombia and Peru, or from the top, as in Venezuela and the United States, which is one reason we all need to be familiar with this song. The original lyrics are in French, but this song has been translated into over 40 languages, including the English version, which begins, "Arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth, for justice thunders condemnation, and a whole new world's in birth." I'd be willing to give bets and lay odds that Barack and Michelle Obama know all the verses by heart. Anyway, I figured that since the Soviet Union was the longest-lasting official communist nation, I'd play you the Russian version. This is the Red Army Chorus. By the way, that might be a good topic for anyone who wants to jump in here with an MP3 submission of their own. How did you yourself become racially aware? How did you find out about the Northwest Migration? Tell us your story in a brief audio file, and assuming it's at least somewhat coherent and you don't go on about the UFOs and the lost continent of Atlantis, I'll put it on here. Please bear in mind that I need an actual MP3 file, not Real Player or any of these obsolete or weird out there formats that my Windows Media Player and my WavePad can't recognize, okay? All right, next email is from Lee in Arizona. Dear Mr. Covington, in your latest copy of the White Nationalist email list, you mentioned that you wanted 1,000 Class A's to come to you in the Pacific Northwest, and from them you would give us the Northwest Republic. Please define exactly what you mean by Class A's. Surely, although this impinges on that area where people start screaming, "No, no, Harold, you mustn't talk about these things in public!" Yep, it's our old friend the character issue again. Well, all I can say is that we've been not talking about these things in public for the past 50 years now, and we can all see what a brilliant success that strategy has been. For those of you who are unfamiliar with what Lee's referring to, about once or twice a week for the past several months, I've been sending out a list of people who are willing to publish their email addresses for the purpose of making contact and eventually meeting in person with other white nationalists in their areas. The idea is to try and get this white thing at least somewhat off the internet and back into the real physical world. So far, out of a list of approximately 1,800 email addresses, we have gotten all of 100 white people who are willing to step forward and physically meet someone else off the internet. Or so they say. It's taken us about 4 months to do that. Every time I send out the list, one or two more people see the beginnings of a crowd that they can hide in, and they're emboldened to peep timidly out from behind their computers and add their names to the list. As I've said before, the white man is a domesticated herd animal now, and he's still capable of at least a little bit of courage so long as he doesn't have to leave the herd and you can show him a crowd to hide in. We do still have a kind of nigger courage. White males can still be a little bit brave so long as they're in a gang or a group, and even braver, of course, if they have permission from our lords and masters to show courage and initiative. It's exercising those things off our own bat that's the problem. I may have mentioned the old saying that war is when you let the government decide who the enemy is and revolution is when you decide for yourself. Well, us pale faces have trouble when it comes to deciding things for ourselves. We still have to have that permission slip from the kikes. Apparently, there have been a few actual physical meetings that have taken place off this list, and so far they seem to have gone well. I just wonder what the hell is up with those other 1,700 people. I guess the crowd isn't big enough for them to hide in yet, but as the list gets longer, I suspect more and more of them will peep out from behind their computers. It's kind of like making friends with Bambi or some other frail and timid woodland creature. You have to hold out your hand with sugar or an apple in it and try to entice white people out into the open. Anyway, in one of my introductions to a recent edition of the White Nationalist email list, I repeated something that I've said on the show on several prior occasions, i.e., give me 1,000 Class A people here in the Northwest and we'll win. And Lee wants me to define what I mean by Class A person. Okay, here's a kind of a thumbnail sketch of the kind of person we need to come here and fight for white freedom in the homeland. The first requirement is that a Class A person be white. Now, that may sound silly, but I assure you it's a criterion we need to establish from the get-go. Now, I'm not going to go off into one of these long, abstruse debates involving 19th century racial theory about who is white. I favor the 30-second test. If there's any doubt in your mind at all after 30 seconds when you meet someone for the first time, then it's probably best to take a pass on that person. Trust your racial instincts. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a very bad movement tendency to try and use or get mileage out of Jews and half-Jews, niggers and demi-niggers, gooks and bugger boys. We try to draw strength of numbers and strength of character from these people because we ourselves have so little of it. Because our Aryan blood has become so thinned out and watered down in both the physical and the metaphysical sense. We become such weaklings that we try to lean on the strength of our enemies. We no longer have the inner strength of our ancestors. Help, 1,700 of us out of 1,800 are too terrified even to post our email addresses in public. So we try to leech off and lean on the courage and strength of some of these non-white groups that still have some. Believe it or not, there are some groups like the BNP in England and certain other European so-called nationalist groups who have made an actual policy out of this, who allow all of these kinds of non-white and degenerate people I just mentioned into their organization and into their homes and use them in their political work. I have seen actual campaign literature with a BNP local council candidate proudly posing for a photo with his racially mixed grandchildren, not to mention a recent website describing the BNP in Israel Israel as quote-unquote comrades in arms. There is, in fact, a name for this. It's called movement modernization, which, effectively speaking, means accepting Jews as white and homosexuals as tolerable so long as they're discreet. We do have a few so-called racist groups in our country like that. One in particular springs to mind, but that's a topic all unto itself, which I'm not going to get into now. Just for the record, though, no, the Northwest Front is not quote-unquote modernized in that sense. Guys, we're doing what we're doing for whites only. If we're going to admit non-whites and perverts and so-called good Jews as some kind of allies or try to borrow from them some of the strength of character which our own people lack, then what the hell is the point in doing any of this? It would be an admission that we really have nothing worth saving of our own, and whether or not that's the case, it's not something I ever intend to concede in public. So that's the first requirement for a Class A Northwest independence activist. This Northwest thing of ours is a whites-only gig. The second requirement is that a Class A needs to be a pretty sharp individual. No American dumbasses need apply. I don't mean he or she has to have a genius-level IQ. I don't mean that he or she has to have a college degree. Considering the state of most colleges and universities these days, that wouldn't be much of a recommendation anyway. No, a Class A white nationalist has something which millions of white people, especially millions of young white people, no longer have, and that's the ability to think rather than to feel. If you watch TV at all, you will notice that usually when some media person personality type is interviewing some average Joe the Plumber or Marge Simpson character, the media guy will ask, how do you feel about this and such, not what do you think about it? The Class A white nationalist, more often than not, is someone who has come to their racial conclusions more or less independently on their own and not because they were raised in it by their families, which is something that seldom happens anymore. Indeed, that's one of our problems. White children no longer get any kind of racial or moral ethics instilled in them by their materialistic American parents, and they're forced to go looking on the internet and elsewhere for answers to their questions about the world and why it is the way it is. All too often, they find the wrong answers. A Class A white nationalist is someone who is capable of investigating and determining why the world is the way it is for themselves, and who is capable of assimilating and accepting the fact that the Northwest migration is the only solution. A white nationalist who knows his Jews and his Bilderbergers and who has all kinds of knowledge about the problem but who doesn't get the solution, somebody who still thinks there's some way we can make all our problems vanish in a puff of smoke without ever pulling a trigger, someone who wants to restore the world of the Brady Bunch without any bloodshed or risk or effort, well, somebody like that can't really be called a Class A, maybe a Class B nationalist. Understanding the problem is getting there, a big part of it, but it's only the first step. You've got to understand the solution as well. Now, third, a Class A person of the kind I'm talking about must be functional in society. He or she has to be able to come here off their own bat and under their own steam. They have to be able to acquire and set up a home in the homeland, and they must be able to obtain and hold gainful employment or self-employment and support themselves financially, because, quite frankly, we can't help them at this time, and we won't be able to do so for quite a while. There will come a time when new migrants can be assisted, both physically and financially, and they can be given concrete help in finding such things as housing and employment. Now, that time is not yet, because we don't have enough Class A's currently resident in the homeland. Now, that's another mark of a Class A Northwest pioneer. He or she understands that they are going first, that there is no safety net as yet, and that part of their task will be to get settled in and begin weaving the safety net for those who will come after. Now, there will be a time for the T-shirt youth, the young men, and nowadays a few young women, with nothing but the T-shirts on their backs. There will come a time when we can provide a bunkhouse and a fridge, although there won't be any beer in the fridge, and it won't be an Aryan Nation-style deal where they just lounge around flashing their tats and posing for the cameras. There won't be any cameras, and when they do come, the T-shirt youth will be kept so busy by the party that they won't have time to do much sleeping in that bunkhouse. A lot of all that trouble they used to have up at Hayden Lake was due to the devil making work for idle hands, and that's a problem that the Northwest Front can't allow to arise, but for the time being, new pioneers have to come here under their own steam and using their own assets. Now, another thing, Class A Northwest activists must be unencumbered and completely free to make a lifelong commitment to the cause of Northwest independence. Now, by that I mean they must not be embroiled in the 1001 nasty, annoying, and draining little dysfunctional life situations that white people in America seem prone to get themselves into these days. I've already mentioned that Class A people must be economically self-sufficient and not dependent on the party, since we can't house or support anybody, but there's much more than that. Class A's must not be in the middle of a nasty divorce or child custody battle. Class A's must not be on parole or probation. They must not be fighting some kind of nuisance lawsuit or legal case. Especially, they can't be involved in one of these endless criminal cases that the system specializes in. Now, they can't be on bail or on remand or on conditions in some legal mess that restricts their freedom of participation in political activity. Basically, Class A's must not be in any way, shape, or form entangled within the system's judicial machinery. Ideally, they should be completely unknown to the system and off the radar, except possibly as an internet pseudonym. Class A white nationalists should ideally be young enough to have some tread left on the tire so that the term long haul actually means something. Now, I'm not knocking all you codgers and crones and coots out there. Remember, I'm one of you myself. But I say again, revolution is a young man's game, and the Tea Party notwithstanding, we cannot storm the barricades with some kind of geriatric mob in our wheelchairs and our walkers. We have got to get some young people and some medium young people, say 30-somethings, in on this. Neither can we storm the barricades while dragging one or two elderly parents or relatives after us in their wheelchairs and walkers. Okay, now I'm going to have to choose my words really carefully here because this is one of those topics where I'm going to get this business of, oh, Harold is talking bad about me. Harold is being mean and cruel. No, I'm not, but we have enough people who are in this situation so that every damned one of you is going to be sure that I'm talking about you personally, and I'm not. Are we clear on this? I'm not talking about any one person individually here. I'm talking about all of you, at least a couple of dozen individual cases to my knowledge. I'm referring to a phenomenon which is really starting to hold us up, and that's white nationalists in their 30s and 40s entering the best and most potentially productive years of their lives who have gotten stuck with taking care of the old folks, usually because the non-racist siblings simply refuse and dump it onto them, but sometimes because there's simply no one else and the alternative is a government-run nursing home, which is basically a form of managed death. Now, I'm not being mean and cruel here and suggesting that you dump Daddy or Meemaw in a home, okay? Are we clear on that? To be honest, I don't have a solution for that problem. It simply depends on what your own conscience will allow in your own individual situation. I'm simply making the practical observation that a Class A activist, in order to be considered a Class A, will somehow have managed to free up his time so that he's available for political work with the Northwest Front. A Class A activist can't be constantly leaving meetings early and missing activities and cutting back on party work in order to look in on and take care of an elderly relative. Well, that was one good thing we had about the Old South for about 80 years. You could always hire some old Uncle Tom or Aunt Jemima Nigger to drive Miss Daisy and take care of the old folks while the younger generation got on with having a life. Nowadays, any non-white you hire to take care of an elderly relative, or any white for that matter, will probably end up poisoning the old boy or the old lady after swindling them out of their bank account. Now, this is just a fact of life. If you're in that position, then you're doing something honorable and noble. I get that, but we got to be honest and practical about this. I can't really give you a call and say, be on Interstate 5 at exit so-and-so at dawn tomorrow. The revolution begins. Because you may say, I can't make that. I have to cook breakfast for Meemaw. You see what I'm saying? A Class A revolutionary lives for the revolution. Seeing is how we've already played some communist music, I wonder if it would help to go over Nechayev's old revolutionary catechism. I published that on a few occasions before. Well, let's take another music break before I get into that. You know, I've played a lot of Irish and Scottish music on this program, but sometimes we forget that there's another Celtic people in the British Isles who have actually done a lot better job of maintaining their own language and national identity than either the Scots or the Irish, and that's the Welsh, whose language is called Cymraeg. In Wales itself, a whopping 22% of the people still speak it on a daily basis, and that's a hell of a lot more than the handful of monoglot Irish speakers still hanging around out on the west coast of Ireland. A lot of those are actually paid by the government to keep on speaking it. The figure is even worse in Scotland, where only 1.2% of the people speak any Gaelic at all with any fluency, and that's only in the Outer Hebrides. Like their Irish and Scottish cousins, the Welsh have their own musical forms, but these tend to be much older. They're great harpers, and every year there's what's called Eisteddfods all over Wales, where bardic poets gather to sing and recite and keep alive the old traditions. But above all, the Welsh are the world's greatest choral singers. Now, the one Welsh joke I know tells about how a busload of Welsh rugby players were on their way home after defeating an English team, and they were all getting pretty loaded and singing all the old songs. One guy kept singing out of tune and hitting all the wrong notes, and finally the captain of the team gets really pissed off with this guy, and he tells him, "Now, die! If you're too drunk to sing properly, properly, you're just going to have to drive. Sorry, I can't do a Welsh accent. I won't even attempt to pronounce the name of this song in Welsh, but it's about King Arthur, who, contrary to popular myth, was not an English national hero, but a Welsh king who managed to defeat the Saxons and turn them back for a bit during his lifetime. Now, this is the City of Glasgow Welsh Choral Society.
Oh.
Okay, I pulled out my copy of Sergei Nechayev's Revolutionary Catechism, and after some thought, no, I won't go over it point by point. Not just because Rufus and his kind would scream, "Hurl the communist, hurl the communist," but because this was written in the 1860s, and a lot of it is kind of dated and not really applicable to today's situation, unless you have a really deep and philosophical turn of mind. I do, but most don't, and that's fine. I get that. I can't blame ordinary people for not being a mine of information on 19th century Russian anarchist movements. I'll tell you what, though. I'd like to suggest something to you folks. I've been dealing with Rufus and his kind. By the way, there is no real Rufus. I'm just assigning a name here to a phenomenon. I've been dealing with Rufus and his kind, yelling, "Hurl's a communist! Hurl's a communist!" for years. I used to get a lot more of that back in the old days when I was an open National Socialist, because there are a lot of people around who, honest to God, don't know what a National Socialist is. They hear the word socialism, and they immediately see pictures of Lenin and Mao Zedong dancing before their eyes, which ain't necessarily so. But more so than that, I've noticed that most people, especially Americans, don't have a clue on earth what a communist really is or what communism is all about. And I'm curious, how many of you listeners out there think that you do? Explain to me what you think communism is and who and what you think communists really are. I'd be interested to know. Email me, or better yet, make me an MP3 audio file, and I'll talk about that on the next week's show. Be interested to see what kind of responses I get. I'll give you one hint. Commander George Lincoln Rockwell defined communism as the organized revolt of the non-white masses of the world against the moral and political authority of the white man. Now see what you guys can come up with. The next email isn't really an email. It's a few comments based on a series of emails I've been exchanging over the past few weeks with a gentleman who is in the half-conservative, half-white nationalist mode I described a bit earlier in this program. Let's call him a Class B white nationalist. Anyway, I've mentioned in the past that if anybody can ever come up with a plan to take all of America back at once, so we don't all have to move to the Northwest homeland, and we can basically just sit in our present living rooms and rec rooms and tap, 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 tap on the keyboard and get it all done that way, well, please lay it on me, and I'll listen with polite attention, and if there's anything to it, I will be happy to discuss the matter. Well, this gentleman took me up on it, and I won't give his name because I don't want him to think that I am in any way ragging on him or insulting him or anything like that. That's not my intention. Movement people have skins as thin as tissue paper, and any criticism is always taken as a deadly personal insult. Now, I'm going to play straight with this guy. I'm going to describe his plan to you as simply and as fairly as I can. Now, this man's plan to take back all of America from sea to shining sea is as follows. First, we get together a whole bunch of really rich conservative businessman types who would be able to finance this project. We gather them all in some kind of secret meeting in a ski lodge or a luxury resort hotel or something like that, kind of like the Bilderbergers, and we swear them to secrecy. Basically, that's the foundation of this whole plan, to create a kind of white Bilderberg group. And I have to say, it's not as impossible as it sounds. I'm sure there are many angry conservative white millionaires out there, especially since Obama and his Jew crew came to power. Now, such men do exist. They hang around people like Willis Cardo and Alex Jones and maybe Rush Limbaugh. So finding a group of white millionaires and billionaires and getting them all in one room would take a lot of doing, but it's not impossible. Now then, according to the plan, we get these rich conservatives to create a number of nice, respectable-sounding scholarship funds for the purpose of sending deserving young men and women through college. Of course, they can't be overtly racial at all, since racially discriminatory scholarships are only allowed for niggers, Jews, women, and bugger boys. And no, I'm not making that up. There's a United Negro College Fund, but a United White College Fund would never be allowed to exist. Just somehow, the recipients of these scholarships of ours will always happen to be bright young white boys and some girls as well, although girls can still get all kinds of other scholarships that are denied to white males, so it would be mostly white boys who would receive them. Now, these scholarships that just happen always to be filled by deserving young white men will sometimes be for things like science or engineering degrees, but mostly for two things: law school and education degrees for producing teachers. In fact, perhaps our white Bilderbergers can eventually create our own colleges and universities like Bob Jones University and Hillsdale College, except, of course, under a veil of academic respectability. The main objective of these scholarships would be to produce teachers and politicians. But to make a long story short, at some point in time, 20 or 30 years from now, all of these scholarship boys and girls would join the Republican Party and form their own faction and start running for office, when they'd be backed up by the immense cash reserves of this mysterious white Bilderberg group. And then they take over the existing system and presumably solve all the problems. Now, the guy who's come up with this plan is a little vague on exactly how that last part would work in practice, but I'm willing to give him the same benefit of the doubt that a lot of people give me when I can't detail A, B, C, D what the Northwest Republic would do in a given situation. Okay, I think most of you folks out there will be able to spot the problems in this plan. Now, the first and most obvious one is that we don't have 20 or 30 years of prosperity and stability anymore to put this plan into action. It's just possible that had this been begun back in the 1960s, something might have been accomplished by now, although I doubt it. Because then we run into the second major problem, and that is that democracy doesn't work. The purpose of democracy is to prevent change, exactly the kind of change we want to bring about. And that's why it's virtually impossible to gain power through the electoral system. In 2008, it cost the Democrats $500 million channeled into the Obama campaign alone, never mind the sum of all the money into all their other campaigns for Congress and state offices. In the aggregate, it probably costs either major party a couple of billion dollars to get a president in the White House and a majority of both houses of Congress ready to do that president's bidding. And even if our white Bilderberg group were able to come up with that kind of money, do you think the existing Jewish power structure would ever let us in, knowing as they would that we intended to create real change and take away their power forever? Okay, I could go on and on about this, but rather than sit here and trash this guy's plan until the cows come home, let me invite you folks out there to respond. Now, am I off base here? Do you think that assuming all these white millionaires could be gotten together and gotten on board, something like this would work? I'm asking now because in the future, there will be people who come at us Northwesters every now and then with some kind of hotshot alternative plan that they say will somehow bring back the good old days, turn back the clock, bring back the Brady Bunch, take back all of America from sea to shining sea and make all of our racial problems, including 40 million niggers and 40 million beaners, just sort of vanish like Scotty beamed them all up to the Enterprise. We won't have to move, we won't have to do anything, we won't have to take any risks, just give this guy money and applause. Your typical right-wing snake oil salesman, in other words. But some of these guys can be really convincing and seductive, and we're going to have to be ready for them. I need to get you people thinking on your own. We need to know how to deal with guys like this that come along and try and sell us snake oil. I'm not implying, by the way, that this gentleman is trying to sell snake oil. Like so many people, he honestly believes that he is the first one to dream this thing up, and he's very sincere about what he's saying. He doesn't realize that in the past 50 years in the movement, we've just seen it all, done it all, heard it all. I mean, I honestly don't think this movement could come up with anything anymore that would surprise me. That includes the aliens coming down to visit Bo Gright in the parking lot up in Idaho, but we won't get into that. I know myself how and why this plan wouldn't work, but do you know? Can you work out for yourselves what's wrong with it besides a couple of hints I've given you? Let me know, preferably in the form of a 7 or 8 minute MP3 audio file. Now, this seems to be an episode for strange musical stuff, so I'm going to play something for you here that I find a bit eerie. If you know anything about Russian history, you'll notice that under the czars, a lot of noblemen and generals and prominent men in Russia had German names. Now, this is because they were Russians, but of Germanic descent. Starting in the 16th century under Ivan the Terrible and moving on to the 17th and 18th centuries under Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, Russian czars went through these periodic spasms of trying to improve and westernize their country, their industry, their economy, their military, and their infrastructure with skilled foreigners, mostly Germans. And every time a new wave of German engineers or bankers or mercenary commanders or artists or mechanics or craftsmen hit Russia, for some reason the czars always ended up giving them land along the Volga River. Now, thus were created the Volga Germans, Volga Deutsche or Russland Deutsche in German, Povolsky Nemtsy in Russian. After a while, there were thousands of them, and then tens of thousands of them, and finally, by 1914, on the eve of the First World War, there were hundreds of thousands of these Volga Germans. Now there are none. In the 1920s and 1930s, Joseph Stalin killed them all, either through outright murder or sending them into exile in Siberia. Oh, there were a few left who were evacuated back to Germany by the Wehrmacht and the SS during the Second World War, but that was the last of them. They existed as a people for almost 400 years, and now they don't anymore, just like the Afrikaners won't exist anymore after another 10 or 20 years. Up until recently, it was forbidden even to mention these people in Russia. They were officially sent down the Soviet memory hole. but now that's lifted somewhat. This is a strange-sounding song called Volgalied, Song of the Volga. It's sung in the Volga German dialect by one of Russia's greatest baritones, Ivan Rebrov, and it's got a lot of Russian-sounding balalaikas and stuff in it, but I find it most chilling that apparently the makers of this record couldn't find a Volga German singer for this, and they had to use a Russian. Like the Greenland Vikings, there just aren't any left. On Monday, August the 16th, Comrade Bruce Carroll Pierce of the Order died at the Allenwood concentration camp in Pennsylvania. The cause of death is as yet unknown. He was 56 years old, and he will be missed. I will now read what I believe is the last article that Comrade Pierce ever wrote for the movement. It's entitled Chrysalis. The definition of chrysalis is the process whereby a caterpillar enters its cocoon and begins the transformation of becoming the butterfly we have all come to appreciate. In this case, I'm referring to the term as meaning something in the process of change, a metamorphosis or transformation that takes place in all things for better or worse. More specifically, I'm referring to the emotional and spiritual change occurring in each of us every day, for good or bad as a result of environmental factors in our surroundings. Our environment is determined largely by the effects of the media on us, be it print or screen, and now including the internet. The values promoted by the media and the internet are very often contrary to those we in the cause hold dear. They promote sodomy, we heterosexuality. They promiscuity, we monogamy. They internationalism, we nationalism. They promote democracy, we promote theocracy or national socialism. They advocate miscegenation, we teach racial purity. They speak of welfare, we speak of individual charity and responsibility. They want to tax us to the level of extortion. We tithe. They speak of immorality. We speak of virtue. They speak of materialism. We speak of idealism, etc., etc. There is no escape from the negative influences of our surroundings unless it's counteracted by a force, influence, or example of equal or greater intensity. Where do we look for a positive influence and example? I hope to offer in this article that follows some counterweights to these dangerous influences of our environment upon men and our duty to the cause and their families. I am an unashamed, primitive Christian, and my perspective will be from that point of view. Still, I think that most of what follows can be applied to each man of the cause, whatever his motivation and beliefs. The negative effects of the media on our environment are incalculable, insidious, and often without our awareness, not unlike the proverbial frog being slowly boiled alive in the kitchen stove. They remind me of a short story I heard long ago. To serve man, it seems aliens from a distant planet landed on Earth and soon began to solve all of mankind's problems. When asked why they were so benevolent, they answered by proffering as evidence a large bound book titled in their script, To Serve Man. Meanwhile, excited throngs of Earthlings began to travel on the aliens' starships to their distant home planet. Then arrived one day an excited young linguist who, upon successful translation, exclaimed, "To serve man was a cookbook of recipes on how to prepare man as a dinner dish." The aliens among us who control the media that so influence our environment also proclaim to have benevolent intentions. We, like the unsuspecting Earthlings of the story, are being slowly and inextricably softened up and prepared by these enemies of our God, race, and truth for the destruction of ourselves, our traditions, and all that we hold dear. Though we, like the unwitting recipients of the aliens' technological benevolence, are well aware of the corrupting influences and dangers of this wicked environment to our spirits and souls. Therefore, the fault of the decline of the proper behavior of men of our cause is largely our own, for with foreknowledge we have partaken of the poison that is contributing to the demise of our folk. Our enemies know that in order to destroy our folk, they must first weaken our resolve and compromise our men morally, which in turn weakens the family unit, which is the foundation and nucleus upon which our race and culture is founded. Having now recognized and discerned this change wrought in our folk and the subsequent decline of the moral principle and fiber of our men, we must endeavor to discover what kind of men were our fathers and the generations of our fathers before the advent of the negative media influence on our environment. Hopefully, we should be able to identify those virtues our folk once considered sacred and venerated, those ideas we held up as examples we wish to resemble, and we will compare them to the virtues of the men we have become. To find such an example, we need only cast our attention back not to the dim ages of antiquity, but to a mere 150 years ago to consider a man who, in my humble opinion, was the most noble and honorable white man born in North America, Robert E. Lee. It is not that he was a great Confederate general during the War between the States, or rather the War of Northern Aggression, after the South exercised her constitutional right to secede from the Union. This conflict was but the tragedy on the stage of history that brought Lee's character under all conditions to our attention. A man who said, "Human virtue should be equal to human calamity." We shall now examine how his example is worthy of our consideration and emulation. Robert E. Lee's religion blended with the code of noblesse oblige, or honor impels. This, equally with his devotion to duty, resolved every issue in his life to black and white. There was no zone of gray or situational ethics in his life. His belief in God, as a gentleman of noble soul, never permitted him to break a vow or mistreat a friend, foe, or creature, and to always honor his word, even if such were unaccountably to rebound against his intentions. A man who said, "Duty is the sublimest word in our language. You cannot do more. You should never wish to do less." How few of us men nowadays say as much. We cast aside commitments and vows with ease when the ethic of the situation doesn't serve our selfish needs. Too often our wives and children are cast off when they no longer excite us, suit our gratification, or the responsibility becomes an inconvenience. We mix and change them like so much clothing. We despise the immoral antics of non-Caucasians, yet we behave in a fashion no better than they. Robert E. Lee was never a self-promoter and never sought praise or attempted to capitalize on his good name. Nor, after the Civil War, did he attempt to avoid the potential consequences of his decision to support the Southern states' right to secede. After the war, Lee was destitute and his profession was gone. When offered $50,000 a year for the use of his name, he said, "My name is not for sale at any price." When an English lord offered him an estate and $15,000 a year, he said, "I must abide the fortunes and share the fate of my people." How many of us in this me-first generation of self-promotion that characterizes our age strive for the same humility that has always distinguished the very best men of our race? Instead of seeking exaltation and to be served, let us first serve with self-sacrifice and nobility our God, our families, and the cause. Robert E. Lee, it is said, was calm when others were anxious, loving when they were hated, and silent when they spoke with bitter tongue. While in the United States Army before the Civil War, Lee was asked his opinion of a fellow officer who had, in fact, been slandering him. Lee gave a good report of the man. When asked if he knew what the man had said about him, he said, "Yes. But you asked my opinion of him, not his of me." Too often we are bitter with our circumstances and slander one another treacherously for trivial reasons of dislike and pettiness, particularly when others do not share our opinions. Now, this is unbecoming to any people, especially in those of us who are ambassadors of the cause. Robert E. Lee was brave. His long indifference to danger bears out his bravery both during the war with Mexico and the Civil War. Though the commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, he attempted on several desperate occasions to lead a countercharge. President Eisenhower said in defense of Lee, "A nation of men of Lee's caliber would be incomparable in spirit and soul." In an age of hedonism, materialism, and the extreme of creature comforts, how many of us are idealistic, selfless, and brave enough to risk our very lives for a cause outside of our immediate self-interest and the truth it represents? These few examples of Lee's character and virtue under all conditions should suffice to serve as an example of the type of man we should strive to emulate. I know of no one this side of the grave who possesses the same degree of attributes that he did. Senator Ben Hill of Georgia said before the U.S. Senate, "He was a friend without treachery, a foe without hate, a Christian without hypocrisy, and a man without guile." Still, while we yet breathe, we must always practice virtue until it becomes a habit, and daily teach those virtues to our children in word and example, and hold them up as the highest worth and value that a man can attain. Additionally, we must kindly but firmly hold one another accountable to a code of conduct, be they elders and esteemed, or the young and inexperienced. Without accountability, each man becomes a law unto himself, determining his own standard of right and wrong, and an isle of despotism and self-righteousness. By our silence, we condone bad behavior and contribute to the license and wickedness that will ultimately lead to disunion, anarchy, and the destruction of our folk and our culture. Finally, with these thoughts in mind, we must now begin the transformation and metamorphosis from self-destructive and race-destructive behavior that we have been conditioned to. Let us erect walls between ourselves and turn our backs on this profane age, and instead let our souls mirror what is noble, pure, honorable, and gracious. Serving God, Race, and Truth, Bruce C. Pierce. These are the last words of a man who gave his life for our cause and for the Northwest American Republic. Let's make sure we don't forget him. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andenman, freedom. Who would follow in their footsteps of the rising moon?